Chapter 14. Situation Room. Just before 7 o'clock on the morning of Tuesday, April 4th, the 74th day of the Trump presidency, Syrian government forces attacked the rebel-held town of Khan Sheikhoun with chemical weapons. Scores of children were killed. It was the first time a major outside event had intruded into the Trump presidency. Most presidencies are shaped by external crises. The presidency, in its most critical role, is a reactive job. Much of the alarm about Donald Trump came from the widespread conviction that he could not be counted on to be cool or deliberate in the face of a storm. He had been lucky so far, 10 weeks in, and he had not been seriously tested. In part, this might have been because the crises generated from inside the White House had overshadowed all outside contenders. Even a gruesome attack, even one on children in an already long war, might not yet be a presidential game changer of the kind that everyone knew would surely come. Still, these were chemical weapons launched by a repeat offender, Bashar al-Assad. In any other presidency, such an atrocity would command a considered and ideally skillful response. Obama's consideration had, in fact, been less than skillful in proclaiming the use of chemical weapons as a red line and then allowing it to be crossed. Almost nobody in the Trump administration was willing to predict how the president might react, or even whether he would react. Did he think the chemical attack important or unimportant? No one could say. If the Trump White House was as unsettling as any in American history, the president's views of foreign policy and the world at large were among its most random, uninformed, and seemingly capricious aspects. His advisors didn't know whether he was an isolationist or a militarist, or whether he could distinguish between the two. He was enamored with generals and determined that people with military command experience take the lead in foreign policy. But he hated to be told what to do. He was against nation building, but he believed there were few situations that he couldn't personally make better. He had little to no experience in foreign policy, but he had no respect for the experts either. Suddenly, the question of how the president might respond to the attack in Khan Sheikhoun was a litmus test for normality and those who hoped to represent it in Trump's White House. Here was the kind of dramatic juxtaposition that might make for a vivid and efficient piece of theater. People working in the Trump White House who were trying to behave normally. Surprisingly, perhaps, there were quite a few such people. Acting normal, embodying normality, doing things the way a striving, achieving, rational person would do them, was how Dina Powell saw her job in the White House. At 43, Powell had made a career at the intersection of the corporate world and public policy. She did well, very, very well, by doing good. She had made great strides in George W. Bush's White House, and then later at Goldman Sachs, returning to the White House at a penultimate level, with at least a chance of rising to one of the country's highest unelected positions, would potentially be worth enormous sums when she returned to the corporate world. In Trump land, however, the exact opposite could happen. Powell's carefully cultivated reputation, her brand, and she was one of those people who thought intently about their personal brand, could become inextricably tied to the Trump brand. Worse, she could become part of what might easily turn into historical calamity. Already, for many people who knew Dina Powell, and everybody who was anybody knew Dina Powell, the fact that she had taken a position in the Trump White House indicated either recklessness or seriously bad judgment. How, wondered one of her longtime friends, does she rationalize this? Friends, family, and neighbors asked, silently or openly, do you know what you're doing? And how could you? And why would you? Here was the line dividing those whose reasons for being in the White House was a professional loyalty to the president from the professionals they had needed to hire. Bannon, Conway, and Hicks, along with an assortment of more or less peculiar ideologues that had attached themselves to Trump and, of course, his family, all people without clearly monetizable reputations before their association with Trump, were, for better or worse, hitched to him. Even among dedicated Trumpers, there was always a certain amount of holding their breath and constant re-examination of their options. But those within the larger circle of White House influence, those with some stature, or at least an imagined stature, had to work through significantly more complicated contortions of personal and career justification. Often they wore their qualms on their sleeves. Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, made a point of stressing the fact that he worked in the executive office building, not the West Wing. Michael Anton, holding down Ben Rhodes' former job at the NSC, had perfected a deft eye roll, referred to as the Anton eye roll. H.R. McMaster seemed to wear a constant grimace and have perpetual steam rising from his bald head. What's wrong with him? The president often asked. There was, of course, a higher rationale. The White House needed normal, sane, logical, adult professionals. To a person, these pros saw themselves bringing positive attributes, rational minds, analytic powers, significant professional experience, to a situation sorely lacking those things. They were doing their bit to make things more normal and therefore more stable. They were bulwarks, or saw themselves that way, against chaos, impulsiveness, and stupidity. They were less Trump supporters than an antidote to Trump. If it all starts going south, more south than it's already going, I have no doubt that Joe Hagan would himself take personal responsibility and do what needed to be done, said a senior Republican figure in Washington, in an effort at self-reassurance about the former Bush staffer who now served as Trump's deputy chief of staff for operations. But this sense of duty and virtue involved a complicated calculation about your positive effect on the White House versus its negative effect on you. In April, an email originally copied to more than a dozen people went into far wider circulation when it was forwarded and re-forwarded, purporting to represent the views of Gary Cohn and quite succinctly summarizing the appalled sense in much of the White House. The email read, "It's worse than you can imagine. An idiot surrounded by clowns. Trump won't read anything. Not one-page memos, not the brief policy papers, nothing. He gets up halfway through meetings with world leaders because he is bored, and his staff is no better. Kushner is an entitled baby who knows nothing. Bannon is an arrogant prick who thinks he's smarter than he is. Trump is less a person than a collection of terrible traits. No one will survive the first year but his family. I hate the work, but feel I need to stay because I'm the only person there with a clue what he's doing. The reason so few jobs have been filled is that they only accept people who pass ridiculous purity tests, even for mid-level policymaking jobs where the people will never see the light of day. I am in a constant state of shock and horror." Still, the mess that might do serious damage to the nation, and by association to your own brand, might be transcended if you were seen as the person, by dint of competence and professional behavior, taking control of it. Powell, who had come into the White House as an advisor to Ivanka Trump, rose in weeks to a position on the National Security Council, and was then, suddenly, along with Cohn, her Goldman colleague, a contender for some of the highest posts in the administration. At the same time, both she and Cohn were spending a good deal of time with their ad hoc outside advisors on which way they might jump out of the White House. Powell could eye seven-figure comms jobs at various Fortune 100 companies, or a C-suite future at a tech company. Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, after all, had a background in corporate philanthropy and in the Obama administration. Cohn, on his part, already a centimillionaire, was thinking about the World Bank, or the Fed. Ivanka Trump, dealing with some of the same personal and career considerations as Powell, except without a viable escape strategy, was quite in her own corner. Inexpressive, and even bot-like in public, but among friends discursive and strategic, Ivanka had become both more defensive about her father and more alarmed by where his White House was heading. She and her husband blamed this on Bannon and his "let Trump be Trump" philosophy, often interpreted as "let Trump be Bannon." The couple had come to regard him as more diabolical than Rasputin. Hence, it was their job to keep Bannon and the ideologues from the president, who they believed was, in his heart, a practical-minded person, at least in his better moods, swayed only by people preying on his short attention span. In mutually codependent fashion, Ivanka relied on Dina to suggest management tactics that would help her handle her father and the White House, while Dina relied on Ivanka to offer regular assurances that not everyone named Trump was completely crazy. This link meant that within the greater West Wing population, Powell was seen as part of the much tighter family circle, which, while it conferred influence, also made her the target of ever sharper attacks. "She will expose herself as being totally incompetent," said a bitter Katie Walsh, seeing Powell as less a normalizing influence than another aspect of the abnormal Trump family power play. And indeed, both Powell and Cohn had privately concluded that the job they both had their eye on, chief of staff, that singularly necessary White House management position, would always be impossible to perform if the president's daughter and son-in-law, no matter how much they were allied to them, were in de facto command whenever they wanted to exert it. Dina and Ivanka were themselves spearheading an initiative that otherwise would have been a fundamental responsibility of the chief of staff, controlling the president's information flow. The unique problem here was partly how to get information to someone who did not, or could not, or would not read, and who at best listened only selectively. But the other part of the problem was how best to qualify the information that he liked to get. Hope Hicks, after more than a year at his side, had honed her instincts for the kind of information, the clips, that would please him. Bannon, in his intense and confiding voice, could insinuate himself into the president's mind. Kellyanne Conway brought him the latest outrages against him. There were his after-dinner calls, the billionaire chorus, and then cable, itself programmed to reach him, to court him or enrage him. The information he did not get was formal information. The data, the details, the options, the analysis. He didn't do PowerPoint. For anything that smacked of a classroom or of being lectured to, professor was one of his bad words. And he was proud of never going to class, never buying a textbook, never taking a note. He got up and left the room. This was a problem in multiple respects, indeed in almost all the prescribed functions of the presidency, but perhaps most of all it was a problem in the evaluation of strategic military options. The president liked generals. The more fruit salad they wore, the better. The president was very pleased with the compliments he got for appointing generals who commanded the respect that Mattis and Kelly and McMaster were accorded. Pay no attention to Michael Flynn. What the president did not like was listening to generals, who, for the most part, were skilled in the new army jargon of PowerPoint, data dumps, and McKinsey-like presentations. One of the things that endeared Flynn to the president was that Flynn, quite the conspiracist and drama queen, had a vivid storytelling sense. By the time of the Syrian attack on Khan Shaykhun, McMaster had been Trump's national security advisor for only about 6 weeks, yet his efforts to inform the president had already become an exercise in trying to tutor a recalcitrant and resentful student. Recently, Trump's meetings with McMaster had ended up in near acrimony, and now the president was telling several friends that his new national security advisor was too boring and that he was going to fire him. McMaster had been the default choice, a fact that Trump kept returning to. Why had he hired him? He blamed his son-in-law. After the president fired Flynn in February, he had spent 2 days at Mar-a-Lago interviewing replacements, badly taxing his patience. John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and Bannon's consistent choice, made his aggressive light-up-the-world, go-to-war pitch. Then Lieutenant General Robert L. Caslin, Jr., superintendent of the United States Military Academy at West Point, presented himself with what Trump viewed positively as old-fashioned military decorum. "Yes, sir. No, sir. That's correct, sir. Well, I think we know China has some problems, sir." And in short order, it seemed that Trump was selling Caslin on the job. "That's the guy I want," said Trump. "He's got the look." But Caslin demurred. He had never really had a staff job. Kushner thought he might not be ready. "Yeah, but I liked that guy. pressed Trump. Then McMaster, wearing a uniform with his silver star, came in and immediately launched into a wide-ranging lecture on global strategy. Trump was soon and obviously distracted, and as the lecture continued, he began sulking. "That guy bores the shit out of me," announced Trump after McMaster left the room. But Kushner pushed him to take another meeting with McMaster, who the next day showed up without his uniform and in a baggy suit. "He looks like a beer salesman," Trump said, announcing that he would hire McMaster but didn't want to have another meeting with him. Shortly after his appointment, McMaster appeared on Morning Joe. Trump saw the show and noted admiringly, "The guy sure gets good press." The president decided he had made a good hire. By mid-morning on April 4th, a full briefing had been assembled at the White House for the president about the chemical attacks. Along with his daughter and Powell, most members of the president's inner national security circle saw the bombing of Khan Sheikhoun as a straightforward opportunity to register an absolute moral objection. The circumstance was unequivocal. Bashar al-Assad's government, once again defying international law, had used chemical weapons. There was a video documenting the attack and substantial agreement among intelligence agencies about Assad's responsibility. The politics were right. Barack Obama failed to act when confronted with a Syrian chemical attack, and now Trump could. The downside was small. It would be a contained response, and it had the added advantage of seeming to stand up to the Russians, Assad's effective partners in Syria, which would score a political point at home. Bannon, at perhaps his lowest moment of influence in the White House, many still felt that his departure was imminent, was the only voice arguing against a military response. It was a purist's rationale. Keep the United States out of intractable problems and certainly don't increase our involvement in them. He was holding the line against the rising business-as-usual faction, making decisions based on the same set of assumptions, Bannon believed, that had resulted in the Middle East quagmire. It was time to break the standard response pattern of behavior represented by the Jervanka-Powell-Cohn-McMaster alliance. Forget normal. In fact, to Bannon, normal was precisely the problem. The president had already agreed to McMaster's demand that Bannon be removed from the National Security Council, though the change wouldn't be announced until the following day. But Trump was also drawn to Bannon's strategic view. Why do anything if you don't have to? Or why would you do something that doesn't actually get you anything? Since taking office, the president had been developing an intuitive national security view. Keep as many despots who might otherwise screw you as happy as possible. A self-styled strongman, he was also a fundamental appeaser. In this instance, then, why cross the Russians? By the afternoon, the national security team was experiencing a sense of rising panic. The president, in their view, didn't seem to be quite registering the situation. Bannon wasn't helping. His hyper-nationalist approach obviously appealed to the not-always-rational president. A chemical attack didn't change the circumstances on the ground, Bannon argued. Besides, there had been far worse attacks with far more casualties than this one. If you were looking for broken children, you could find them anywhere. Why these broken children? The president was not a debater. Well, not in any Socratic sense. Nor was he, in any conventional sense, a decision maker. And certainly, he was not a student of foreign policy views and options. But this was nevertheless turning into a genuine philosophical face-off. Do nothing had long been viewed as an unacceptable position of helplessness by American foreign policy experts. The instinct to do something was driven by the desire to prove you were not limited to nothing. You couldn't do nothing and show strength, but Bannon's approach was very much a pox on all your houses. It was not our mess, and judging by all recent evidence, no good would come of trying to help clean it up. That effort would cost military lives with no military reward. Bannon, believing in the need for a radical shift in foreign policy, was proposing a new doctrine. Fuck 'em. This iron-fisted isolationism appealed to the president's transactional self. What was in it for us? Or for him? Hence the urgency to get Bannon off the National Security Council. The curious thing is that in the beginning, he was thought to be much more reasonable than Michael Flynn, with his fixation on Iran as the source of all evil. Bannon was supposed to babysit Flynn, but Bannon, quite to Kushner's shock, had not just an isolationist worldview, but an apocalyptic one. Much of the world would burn, and there was nothing you could do about it. The announcement of Bannon's removal was made the day after the attack. That in itself was a rather remarkable accomplishment on the part of the moderates. In little more than 2 months, Trump's radical, if not screwball, national security leadership had been replaced by so-called reasonable people. The job was now to bring the president into this circle of reason. As the day wore on, both Ivanka Trump and Dina Powell were united in their determination to persuade the president to react normally. At the very minimum, an absolute condemnation of the use of chemical weapons, a set of sanctions, and ideally a military response, although not a big one. None of this was in any way exceptional, which was sort of the point. It was critical not to respond in a radical, destabilizing way, including a radical non-response. Kushner was by now complaining to his wife that her father just didn't get it. It had even been difficult to get a consensus on releasing a firm statement about the unacceptability of the use of chemical weapons at the noon press briefing. To both Kushner and McMaster, it seemed obvious that the president was more annoyed about having to think about the attack than by the attack itself. Finally, Ivanka told Dina they needed to show the president a different kind of presentation. Ivanka had long ago figured out how to make successful pitches to her father. You had to push his enthusiasm buttons. He may be a businessman, but numbers didn't do it for him. He was not a spreadsheet jockey. His numbers guy dealt with spreadsheets. He liked big names. He liked the big picture. He liked literal big pictures. He liked to see it. He liked impact. But in one sense, the military, the intelligence community, and the White House's national security team remained behind the times. Theirs was a data world rather than a picture world. As it happened, the attack on Khan Shukun had produced a wealth of visual evidence. Bannon might be right that this attack was no more mortal than countless others, but by focusing on this one and curating the visual proof, this atrocity became singular. Late that afternoon, Ivanka and Dina created a presentation that Bannon, in disgust, characterized as pictures of kids foaming at the mouth. When the two women showed the presentation to the president, he went through it several times. He seemed mesmerized. Watching the president's response, Bannon saw Trumpism melting before his eyes. Trump, despite his visceral resistance to the establishment ass-covering and standard-issue foreign policy expertise that had pulled the country into hopeless wars, was suddenly putty. After seeing all the horrifying photos, he immediately adopted a completely conventional point of view. It seemed inconceivable to him that we couldn't do something. That evening, the president described the pictures in a call to a friend. The foam. All that foam. These are just kids. He usually displayed a consistent contempt for anything but overwhelming military response. Now he expressed a sudden, wide-eyed interest in all kinds of other military options. On Wednesday, April 5th, Trump received a briefing that outlined multiple options for how to respond. But again, McMaster burdened him with detail. He quickly became frustrated, feeling that he was being manipulated. The following day, the president and several of his top aides flew to Florida for a meeting with the Chinese president Xi Jinping, a meeting organized by Kushner with the help of Henry Kissinger. While aboard Air Force One, he held a tightly choreographed meeting of the National Security Council, tying into the staff on the ground. By this point, the decision about how to respond to the chemical attack had already been made. The military would launch a Tomahawk cruise missile strike at Al-Shariat Airfield. After a final round of discussions, while on board, the president, almost ceremonially, ordered the strike for the next day. With the meeting over and the decision made, Trump, in a buoyant mood, came back to chat with reporters traveling with him on Air Force One. In a teasing fashion, he declined to say what he planned to do about Syria. An hour later, Air Force One landed and the president was hustled to Mar-a-Lago. The Chinese president and his wife arrived for dinner shortly after 5 o'clock and were greeted by a military guard on the Mar-a-Lago driveway. With Ivanka supervising arrangements, virtually the entire White House senior staff attended. During a dinner of Dover sole, haricot vert, and thumbelina carrots, Kushner seated with the Chinese first couple, Bannon, at the end of the table, the attack on Al-Shariat airfield was launched. Shortly before 10, the president, reading straight off the teleprompter, announced that the mission had been completed. Dina Powell arranged a for-posterity photo of the president with his advisors and national security team in the makeshift situation room at Mar-a-Lago. She was the only woman in the room. Steve Bannon glowered from his seat at the table, revolted by the stagecraft and the phoniness of the fucking thing. It was a cheerful and relieved Trump who mingled with his guests among the palm trees and mangroves. "That was a big one," he confided to a friend. His national security staff were even more relieved. The unpredictable president seemed almost predictable. The unmanageable president, manageable.